Once a year, I enjoy putting together a story sermon, borrowing liberally from the inspiration and the style of Prairie Home Companion and Garrison Keillor. In his shows, he invariably has musicians that provide music, and then he launches into the latest news from Lake Wobegon. So in keeping with that, I'd like to first read a passage from the New Testament, and then you'll be hearing a selection from Jason Robert Brown, and it's printed on the yellow insert if you want to follow along with the lyrics. Jason Robert Brown is a young Broadway composer who's composed some very important musicals that have lifted up issues around race and society and age and love, and does so with both talent musically and as a lyricist. And so the song that you'll be hearing after the New Testament lesson is one called Someone to Fall Back On. The New Testament lesson comes from Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, in the very first chapter. In verse 18, Paul says, "For the message about the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God." And then reading from verse 26 to the end of the chapter, Paul writes, "Consider your own call, brothers and sisters. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, things that are not, to reduce to nothing the things that are, so that no one might boast in the presence of God. God is your source of your life in Jesus Christ, who became for us wisdom from God, and righteousness, and sanctification, and redemption, in order that, as it is written, let the one who boasts, boasts in the Lord." Friends, this is the word of God. Thanks be to God.
Fighter, don't count on me to storm the barricades and take a stand or hold my ground. You'll never see any scars or wounds. I don't walk on coals. I won't walk on water. I am no prince. I am no saint. I am not anyone's wildest dream. But I can stand behind and be someone to fall back on. You're bruised and beaten down, and I'm the one who's looking for a favor. Still, honestly, you don't believe me, but the things I have are the things you need. You look at me like I don't make sense, like a waste of time, like it serves no purpose. I am no prince, I am no saint, and if that's what you believe you need, you're wrong. You don't need much, you need someone. Take decide if I'm the only one. I'm used to that. I've been alone. I'd rather be the half of us, the least of you, the best of me. And I'll be your prince. I'll be
been a quiet week in Pittsburgh, my new hometown. Summer arrived, gardens were planted, a couple of rainstorms passed through without too much water in our basements. Much of the world has been focused on major sporting events like the World Cup and Wimbledon, but we here in Pittsburgh managed to keep the nation's attention riveted on our little corner of the globe by firing a giant pierogi. Andrew Kurtz is the man at the center of the Pittsburgh Pirates Pierogi Gate, a major news event that was picked up by the Post-Gazette, CBS, Fox Sports, and ESPN. Mr. Kurtz evidently made some disparaging remarks on Facebook concerning the decision to renew the contracts of the Pirates' general manager and team manager. And once he did so, he moved, so to speak, from the frying pan to the fire. But he has since been rehired, but not before revealing some team secrets that are somewhat unsettling. The fact came out that all those people hired to run as pierogies at the Pirates games routinely alternate costumes. So if you're an avid Cheese Chester supporter, that runner may actually be inside the Sauerkraut Saul costume the very next night. So I'm not so sure it was wise to rehire Mr. Kurtz. He admitted that he liked running as Jalapeno Hannah because you get to carry a purse and, quote, you can whack the other pierogies with it, unquote. It's been an interesting week also in terms of people making public apologies. David Cameron, the new Prime Minister of England, made a historic apology expressing sorrow for the 1972 shooting death of 14 Catholic protesters in Northern Ireland, done so by Protestant British soldiers. And a few days ago, General McChrystal apologized to President Obama for ill-chosen words and actions prior to being replaced by General David Petraeus. And of course, British petroleum officials continue to apologize for the horrific oil rig disaster that killed 11 men and the oil spill that is pumping over 60,000 gallon barrels of oil a day into the Gulf waters for over a month. Fortunately, I suppose, BP has a very thick file of public apologies from which to draw from as they make up their daily press releases. They have apologies for the oil spill from 1993 to 95 on Inukat Island in Alaska. They have apologies for the Texas City refinery explosion in 2005 that killed 15 and injured 180. They have apologies for dumping oil near Prudhoe Bay, Alaska in August 2006, in May 2007, and again in October 2007. They have apologies for being fined more than $300 million in 2007 for trying to fix the price of propane gas. Apologies for two of their refineries accounting for 97% of the safety violations detected by OSHA between 2007 and 2010. Part of BP executive Tony Hayward's apology contained the comment that he just wanted to get his life back. He made the comment before being spotted enjoying a yacht race off the coast of the Isle of Wight. Mr. Hayward enjoyed the race because it took place in one of the few patches of ocean not polluted by BP. But for Walter Johansson, apologies have been much on his mind of late. Walter and his wife divorced several years ago when his daughter Julie was near the end of her freshman year in high school. But a few weeks ago, Julie had finished her first year of college at State College and had decided to come live with her father for the summer. It's true that over the past several years, she and her father had not spent a lot of time together. Periodic weekend overnights and day visits were about the extent of it. To Walter, now it seemed like this would be a good time to reestablish a strong father-daughter relationship and perhaps to find a way to apologize for how the divorce had affected Julie's life. But he struggled with how to broach the subject with his daughter. When the decision had been made to get divorced, there was the usual sequence of events. The two parents broke the news to their teenage daughter, stressing that the divorce was not about her but about them, and that they simply couldn't be together any longer. Then came that awkward transition period when Walter moved out, taking part of the home furnishings with him. The court papers were signed, making everything official, and then the alternating weekends began, with Julie spending time in Walter's guest room of a severely under-decorated apartment across town. If Julie was angry about the divorce, she didn't show it very much, at least not to her father. The reality was she'd reached an age in which she was already sharing little of her life with her dad, and the divorce only seemed to make the silences longer and the gaps in communication even deeper. Walter is an English professor, teaches creative writing, and to be honest, he was never cut out for bachelor life. His cooking skills invariably involved leftovers and scary things found on the back of the refrigerator shelves. To say that he was an indifferent dresser was being quite polite. And he sincerely held to the misguided belief that since you were clean after you took your shower, the towel you used to dry off was only whisking away clean water, and therefore that towel didn't need to be washed very often. His daughter Julie used to come in and try to keep him to maintain basic levels of hygiene. It drove her nuts that her father insisted on buying the largest box of Honey Nut Cheerios they sold in the store because it was such a great value, but the box never fit in the kitchen cupboard, so there was always one door constantly ajar in the kitchen. One time Walter hinted to Julie after the divorce that he thought about seeing a psychiatrist, but he was afraid that counselors would only make him so normal and well-adjusted that he could never do any creative writing again. And in response, Julie had stressed to him that, quote, psychiatrists really weren't nearly that good. But despite being gifted with words, when it came to his daughter, when it came to the divorce, Walter had a severe case of writer's block. He felt that he had let her down, that on some level he had failed her, and he knew that he wasn't perfect. His ex-wife certainly knew he wasn't perfect. But as a father, you want to be perfect for your children, to be the knight in shining armor, the prince, the protector, the one who, when they're afraid, is the one whose hand they hold and leads them out of the shadows into the light. You want to be the one who's able to wipe away the tears, to check under the bed for monsters and declare that all is well, to be the one whose kiss or lullaby is what ensures a good night's sleep. And so Walter wondered, how do you admit your failings to your child? Julia's daughter had learned early on that her father could not field grounders, that he danced like his feet were stuck in cement, that he had very funny knees and he should always wear long shorts in summer. But that made him quirky without taking away his essential dadness. But now was the harder question. How could he mention his demons, his fears, his real mess-ups to his own daughter? Walter had never been much of a churchgoer. He used to quote Kurt Vonnegut and claim that he practiced a disorganized religion, an unholy disorder known as Our Lady of Perpetual Consternation. But on one Sunday recently, Walter had gone to church, and the minister had read from Paul's letter to the church in Corinth, where Paul says quite clearly, God did not choose many who were powerful and of noble birth, but instead chose the foolish of the world to shame the wise, the weak of the world to shame the strong, so that no one might boast in God's presence. For Paul, the key to this intentional choice of foolishness triumphing over worldly wisdom was the cross, a wooden cross of crucifixion, a place of loss, of brokenness, of perceived failure and literal death, that was where God's holy other wisdom became revealed for all time. The pastor had said, look, it wasn't as if humans were just going along their merry way when they suddenly made a really bad decision that caused the Son of God to be innocently killed by accident, so that God had to come down and intervene and correct the error through resurrection on Easter Sunday. If that was the true scenario, then God would be reduced to someone like an appliance repairman, who only comes in our lives when something is broken that needs to be fixed. That God would only be like that elementary school teacher who's been out in the hallway and who steps into the classroom and sees a naughty word written on the chalkboard and erases it so that the offense is no longer visible, and then goes on with the lesson plan. God is always much more than that. God felt the depth of pain that exists in this world. God in Christ was born and lived and hungered and worked and sweat and slept like all of us. And all the collective brokenness of life, the lepers and the orphans, the women abused and widowed, the fathers forced to be soldiers or slaves, God intimately joined in that grim reality and did so through the shameful, painful act of being rejected, of being crucified, and then publicly dying as a lowly criminal, unworthy of a grave or a glance of pity. By God going to the cross, what was foolish now became infused with a deeper wisdom. What was a sign of weakness became then a place to find strength. What appeared to be a dead end became instead a place to travel to reflect upon, and something that would allow us to be renamed and our brokenness to be transformed into something that could give life. For our sake, God made him to be sin who knew no sin, that in him we might become the righteousness of God. Walter struggled over how to offer an apology to his daughter, because he knew how prone he was to using his words as a cover for his emotions. He feared that once he would say, I'm sorry, he would slip into language that would too quickly try to explain away the divorce. too quickly seek to defend the logic of that painful act, too quickly try to erase the naughty word from the blackboard so that everyone could just get on with their lives. But there are some things that can't easily be erased by us. Walter didn't know if Julie would understand what he wanted to say, but he knew that before she moved further down life's path, he had to try to talk with her. Since she moved to the house, twice he had caught her, once on the stairs and once heading to the back door, and said that he wanted to sit down with her at some time, that they might have a talk together. And she nodded, but had said that she was in a rush right then. So late one evening before going to bed, while Julie was out on the town, Walter pulled out the cell phone that he grudgingly carried, and he managed to text carefully his daughter with only two misspelled words. And he asked her if she was free for dinner the next night. And a quick response, okay, came back to him just before he rolled over to go to sleep. In hindsight, knowing how special and savvy Julie is, Walter shouldn't have been surprised when he came downstairs the next morning. There on the kitchen table was set up a series of items that had obviously been arranged carefully the night before. A rose in a bud vase, a framed picture of Walter catching Julie as a child after tossing her in the air, a stack of his favorite books carefully pulled from his crowded shelves, Slaughterhouse-Five, Pilgrim at Tinker's Creek, Thurber's Fables, Frost's Poems. And then in front of it was a letter folded and addressed simply to Dad. And Julie wrote these words, "I know you want to talk, and I'm pretty sure you want to talk about stuff like you and Mom and the divorce, and that's okay. I think I'm ready for us to have that conversation. I wasn't ready a few years ago. I kept myself busy to avoid thinking too much about what had happened to our home and the family that I'd known all my life. And often during the last few years, I'd been angry and depressed and confused. I wanted my old life back, yet I wanted you and Mom to finally be happy, only to come to realize that some of the things that we want in life are mutually exclusive, and that can't be helped. While I've been away at college, I've had the chance to meet a lot of people who've been through a lot, who've known pain in their lives, and in some cases don't know who they are or what they believe. And that's helped me get some perspective in my life. Some friends of mine recently saw a picture of you in my dorm room, and they asked me what you were like. And I didn't start by saying, that's my dad who divorced my mom and moved out of the house. I didn't talk about what you do for work. I didn't talk about your clothes. I didn't talk about that funny habit you have of singing theme songs from old TV shows all the time. But I did say that my favorite memory of you was when I would stand in the backyard with my back to you, and then I'd fall back, and you would catch me under my arms and spin me around in a circle, and that you never let me drop. I couldn't see you, I couldn't see your face, but I knew you were there behind me. Dad, you've never let me drop. I'm busy running forward. I'm busy with things in front of my face. But I can go forward because I know that you're behind me to clap for me, to listen to my stories, to catch me when I fall. Some of the most important things in life you don't look at face to face, like God, like love. But you know they're there. That there's something you can trust, that there's something you can fall back on. And that's what you mean to me. I'm looking forward then to having dinner with you tonight." Walter was struck by how, in a place of foolishness and weakness, in a place where he had struggled so hard for words, something this eloquent and wonderful and wise could have taken root and blossomed and been there all along. And that's the news from Pittsburgh, where all the women are strong, all the men are good-looking, and all the Presbyterians are above average.